The Phoenix City Council will now start its meetings with a moment of silence rather than a prayer. But the debate on that change was anything but silent.
This is a spiritual thing. This is in the spiritual realm. This is evil against good. And the devil is out, Satan is out to win. And we don't want to give him Phoenix.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Also today on the show, Glendale picks a new manager for Gila River Arena, how Amazon affects Arizona and its economy.
A controversial pastor looks to start a new church in Phoenix.
And Generation Z goes to college.
You're looking at a very creative and very dedicated group of people who want to leave their mark by changing the world and actually addressing some problems that have been ongoing.
Plus, a new Valley-based magazine covers the disability community, and we take a little off the top.
That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. In Valley traffic, watch out for accidents on the 51 southbound at Bethany Home Road, also the 101 eastbound at 7th Avenue. We'll stay sunny through the rest of this afternoon, may reach a high of 64 degrees. Currently, it's mostly sunny and 58.
Residents in Mesa could soon see an Arizona State University campus move into the downtown area. KJZZ's Kerry Young has the details.
The potential partnership was announced at the Mesa State of the City address Thursday morning. Mayor John Giles says it's part of a larger effort to attract more post-secondary institutions to the community.
To me, the connection and the fit between Arizona State University and downtown Mesa is a great fit. It's very obvious. It's like peanut butter and chocolate.
But it's not a sure thing just yet. City Council must first adopt a memorandum of understanding to begin exploring the partnership and work out specific details. That's expected to make the agenda this month. Carrie Young, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
After a heated debate last night, the Phoenix City Council has voted to end public prayer before council meetings and substitute that for a moment of silent prayer and reflection. The change comes amid controversy over plans by followers of the Satanic Temple in Tucson to give an invocation later this month. The council's decision will prevent the Satanists from doing so, but it had divided the community and city's leaders. KJZZ's Will Stone watched the meeting last night. Will, what were the choices facing the council?
Well, Mark, it was a huge showing at the meeting with dozens and dozens of speakers, and the entire deliberation lasted for several hours. And the issue has really dominated media coverage in the days leading up to the meeting. And the council had several options in front of them. One was to do an emergency rule change to the invocation process so that council members get to invite who comes before them, and that would have immediately gone into effect, so blocking the Satanists. Most of the speakers supported that approach and really painted this in biblical terms. One of them was a longtime Phoenix resident named Mona Constance.
This is a spiritual thing. This is in the spiritual realm. This is evil against good. And the devil is out, Satan is out to win. And we don't want to give him Phoenix.
Will, what was the other option?
The other option, Mark, was advanced by Councilmember Felda Williams, and that was to substitute a moment of silence for the public prayer and have that effective immediately. That also would block the Satanists from giving a public prayer, but it was essentially a compromise, a way of not intentionally discriminating against the Satanists. The hope was put the city in better legal shape so they couldn't be challenged. One of the supporters of this proposal was a Phoenix resident and veteran named Leonard Clark.
This is a country where we are allowed to worship God in our own way. I support the moment of silence, you know, but to sit here and imply that just because we don't want you to pick a particular religion that I agree, I don't even want to say the word.
And that word, of course, Mark, was Satan. And Clark's basic point here was that a moment of silence isn't a tacit affirmation of the Satanic Temple. And it was a response that many council members had, including Mayor Greg Stanton and Thelda Williams, who were offended by the implication that just because they wanted a moment of silence, that meant they supported the Satanists. Their biggest opponent in this was council member Sal DeCiccio, very vocal. And he pretty much said this was a way that the city was trying to ban prayer.
Their main goal, and I want to drive this home, is to silence the other side. And that's done through a moment of silence is basically a banning of prayer.
So, Will, why did the council ultimately go for a moment of silence? Why did they pick that option?
The Constitution. After all the public debate, several hours, the city attorney finally weighed in and said that changing the invocation process retroactively so that council members get to pick who would be speaking, would put the city essentially on the side of a losing lawsuit. And the Satanists had already pledged to sue the city if that happened. Stanton, Councilmember Gallego and others said they had consulted, you know, constitutional experts, and this would put the city in constitutional peril, essentially. So that's why they voted for the moment of silence.
So after the vote last night, what's next?
Well, Sal DiCicco and several other council members who were against the moment of silence have pledged to bring this to a vote of the people or find some way to get prayer back. I even spoke with the councilman this morning, and he says he's gotten in dozens and dozens of calls, and he's going to try to hold a special meeting to get this on the ballot. If not, they will go gather signatures and hopefully have it some. And he claims there are many ways that are constitutional to bring prayer back. And that's what he's going after.
That's KJZZ's Will Stone. Will, thank you.
Thanks, Mark.
So the Phoenix City Council has taken some action on the issue, but the Valley is not unique in having to address public prayer. The U.S. Supreme Court recently heard a related case and issued a decision. To learn more, I'm joined by Michael McConnell. He's director of the Constitutional Law Center at Stanford Law School. Professor, how much of this is about religious freedom?
This is really a question of religious neutrality. When the government is not required to be strictly secular in everything that it does, but when it opens up something like an opportunity to give invocations to private citizens, or in this case private groups, it can't have formal discrimination or unequal treatment of religious groups. It has to treat them all the same.
Is there a risk then when council members will say, well, we want to change that? Is there dangerous territory they're stepping into based on what the law says now? I mean, does a body like that have the freedom to make changes, or is there a danger of contradicting what the law is saying about this?
Well, they have freedom to make changes, but they do not have the freedom to write into the law formal discrimination among religious groups. There may be changes they could make that would have the incidental effect of altering who's going to have priority for giving invocations, but there can be no formal discrimination.
Is there any recent case law, whether at the city level or a different sort of level? Is it cyclical? I mean, is there anything in recent vintage that you can tell us about?
There have been several things. There was a case in the United States Supreme Court a term before last called Town of Greece versus Galloway, Greece being in New York State, about a program very similar to this. And the argument was made that it was unconstitutional because most of the speakers were Christians and some of them used sectarian language in the course of the prayers. The Supreme Court rejected that argument. But still, when cases like that are in the news, it inspires other people to think of other things to do.
When it comes to judicial philosophies on an issue related to this sort of thing, is it easy to pigeonhole one side or the other on this? Are we seeing any crossover between what would be traditionally conservative philosophies and traditionally liberal philosophies as it relates to freedom of religion, freedom of presentation when it comes to this sort of thing?
On an issue like this, there may be some who believe in a strictly secular public space, public sphere, who would be just as opposed to the Satanists having an invocation as the Methodists. And then you might have some who believe in freedom of speech and expression and let a thousand flowers bloom, who say, hey, this is great, we should have them. And then you may have some who say that the government should have some authority to be able to limit public events to the expressions which are going to be broadly uncontroversial and not offensive to anyone.
Okay.
So those different points of view are not all going to line up with left or right.
That's Michael McConnell, director of Stanford's Constitutional Law Center.
Glendale has picked a new company to manage the city-owned Gila River Arena. Officials announced they'd start working out contract details with AEG, which, among other things, owns the LA Kings. The deal could be finalized within a couple of months. Joining me with more on this is Tom Dunsing, Glendale's assistant city manager. Tom, why was this bid the best one for the city?
The feeling around here is we hit a home run with AEG. I can't get into a lot of the details of the proposals, but really what AEG brings is their wealth of experience. They have a worldwide presence. They bring the want to keep the Arizona Coyotes. And I can tell you that is kind of core to what we're doing with them. Their strategy really goes beyond the arena. One of the things that they do is they try to invigorate the area. You only have to look west to go to Staples Center and LA Live, and that's sort of their business strategy is to operate that way. And so we're real excited that not only would they be able to keep the Coyotes, but also bring some excitement, or, you know, there's plenty of excitement now, but kind of step it up a level at Westgate.
Are there metrics by which you'll measure whether or not they're doing a good job?
That will be determined through the contract discussions. And within that, we will detail the elements of the agreement. I tell you, one of the things that we're hoping happens and that we think we can get into this contract is cost certainty. In other words, the city's risk is capped.
Are you pretty confident, though, that the city and AEG are basically on the same page when it comes to what you would like to see both at the arena and at Westgate next door?
You know what? I'm very confident. When we kind of set out on this process, we basically had three core principles. The first principle was, you know, this is about the taxpayers. The second principle that we held by is we want to do what's good for the local business. And then the third principle that we had is we want to maintain an NHL team in our building. And I can tell you with the proposal that was brought forward, they had the exact same thing in mind.
How optimistic are you realistically that the Coyotes will stay in Glendale?
I don't want to be Pollyannish. At the end of the day, the Coyotes will have to do what they have to do. They're very good businessmen, but at the same time, we're very good businessmen. And what we're going to do is work with AEG, and what we want to do is keep the Coyotes here. We have that same goal.
Is it possible, do you think, for the contract and for AEG's work to be considered a success if the Coyotes are not part of the picture, if they leave for somewhere else?
You know, it's hard to say. The discussions so far have been just around keeping the Coyotes. I think if you look at other AEG facilities, you know, Kansas City comes to mind. They're very successful in those type of markets. But at this point, I can tell you the discussions haven't been that way. And we are just proceeding with that same goal of maintaining the Arizona Coyotes.
When you're negotiating the agreement, though, will there be sort of a almost like a plan B, like, okay, here's what we expect, here's what we'd like to see happen, assuming the Coyotes stay here? If, in fact, the Coyotes leave, presumably that makes AEG's job a little more difficult in terms of meeting financial expectations and revenue expectations. Will there be sort of a contingency, do you think, in the contractual language to account for that?
I think there will be. But at this point, AEG has reached out to the Coyotes. The commissioner of the NHL has reached out to the Coyotes. You know, we weren't part of those discussions, but they said they've gone as good as they could go. We've reached out to the Coyotes. So again, everyone is talking. And that, to me, that's the first step in maintaining the team here.
Tom Dunsing is Glendale's assistant city manager. Tom, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Coming up, a new megachurch is opening soon in Phoenix, and it's headed by a controversial pastor.
When you talk to people now, what's really striking is how that trauma still resonates. They talk about it as a kind of spiritual abuse.
The new Trinity Church and Pastor Mark Driscoll. It's the show.
Good afternoon. This is the show on KJZZ with Steve Goldstein. I'm Mark Brody. Quick check of Valley traffic. An accident on the 101 northbound in the East Valley. It's at Chaparral, and it's blocking the right lane. Look for sunny skies for the rest of the afternoon. Still high temperatures, cooler than average. The high today expected to reach 64. 70 is average for today. 57 was our high yesterday. Clear tonight. Overnight lows near 40. Sunny and 69 for a high tomorrow. Right now in Phoenix, under mostly sunny skies, 60 degrees at KJZZ at 219.
KJZZ is supported by SRP, helping to improve air quality with about a third of its energy coming from carbon-free sources, and with a growing fleet of electric vehicles and alternative fuel trucks. Learn more at srpcares.com.
It's the show, along with John Hockenberry at The Takeaway. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. In the early 20th century, human beings became cogs in the giant manufacturing facilities that stamped out cars and cut out the shapes that were sewn into dresses, slacks, and shirts. Gradually, factory floor inventions gave most of the work to machines that are immune to fatigue and maintain their precision through millions of cycles.
The people who made that possible were the working class heroes of an era, people like H. Joseph Gerber, a refugee from Austria and Holocaust survivor. He was named in 1952 on the U.S. Chamber of Commerce's 10 Most Outstanding Young Men in America.
Only under our American economic, moral, and social system is it possible to grow, to compete, and to create as free human beings and as free citizens?
Gerber quite literally freed workers from the intensive and dangerous labor of manufacturing, inventing automated processes and machines that got him dubbed the Thomas Edison of manufacturing. Joseph Gerber's son, David Gerber, has just finished a biography of his dad called The Inventor's Dilemma, The Remarkable Life of H. Joseph Gerber. It's a story of magic and simplicity that began one day when Gerber's father shared his life-changing secret with his son.
I was probably about 12 years old when my dad first showed me his original invention, and he showed me how I could use it for art projects.
What was it exactly?
So this was a device called the variable scale, and what my dad showed me actually was an old pajama waistband. He brought me into his private office where he kept a lot of old memorabilia, and he took this piece of cloth out of a tackle box that he kept there, and he explained to me that this is what he used to start his company, and it was an invention that he came up with in college to solve engineering problems. It was kind of touching as well for me because my dad had been a Holocaust survivor, and that pair of pajamas was the one thing that he had been able to bring to America with him that his father had given him, and his father never made it out.
What is your understanding of what an inventor does based on your experience with your dad? What set him apart from somebody who just made tools in a tool and die shop?
He was very astute at being able to recognize problems, and he was able to see in an object a new use, a metaphor for a new kind of object that he would be able to create.
A metaphor for a new object. So he could look at what you and I see and see something else there.
He could. Maybe his most important invention was the automated cloth cutting machine for making apparel. This is an example as well of a whole new approach to cloth cutting. What he did was he resorted to far-flung analogies, things like food packaging, shoe brushes, airplane wings, not the kind of things you would normally turn to. You know, most engineers, if they were given the task of coming up with a cloth cutting machine, what they would probably do is open a book and look at designs of how cloth cutting machines were made. That wasn't my dad's approach.
Really?
He would ask the question, what are we trying to accomplish here? And he would often come up with very different solutions as a result of that.
We think of inventors like Thomas Edison who are responding to a need that is self-evident. And what you're describing is someone who comes into a situation that no one perceives as having some overwhelming self-evident need and says, you know, can we just like stop for a second and I'll do this a completely different way and it'll be a million times better.
Well, I think of this approach as being kind of like what Steve Jobs did. He came out with products that people didn't realize they had a need for. And he then embodied that in a system, and that system itself created new opportunities for more products. That was very much what my dad did.
Do you think his experience as a Holocaust survivor gave him an ability to see the waste perhaps better than some others?
I think his Holocaust experience had a number of influences on him as an innovator. He started out as a precocious boy who was inventing to cause a lot of trouble. He would electrocute the doorknobs in his room so people would come and get a shock and drop soup and so on.
What a delightful fellow.
Yeah, he was. Well, it was encouraged in his household.
I got you.
And when the Holocaust came, he had to really turn his inventive talents to solving serious imminent problems. He actually saved himself and his family. He and his dad escaped into Switzerland, but then they were turned back over to the Gestapo and put on a train headed toward Dachau. And he figured out how to disengage a latching mechanism on a train car, so he and his father were able to jump the train. And there were a number of these examples. Secondly, I think the Holocaust experience gave him a very different view of risk. It was an environment in which if you did nothing, you're dead.
We talk a lot about how there's a quality of America that encourages this innovation. Is it possible that it's not really American at all, but it's from everywhere else? It just so happens that to be a fish out of water is what's required to empower someone to actually produce those inventions. And, you know, staying in a place like Europe, which is very regimented, you just never get the chance to do what your dad got the chance to do.
I think my dad would have said that being innovative is very American. When he came here, he later told me, he realized that this is the place he had always dreamed of, even though he never knew it existed. When he was a kid in Vienna, he was criticized for asking questions. In America, he was complimented for them. In Austria, people had what he called an anti-innovative attitude. And when he came to America, he saw that there was opportunity to express yourself. And he thrived in this environment.
Well, what a proud son you are.
I'll call it a grateful son. I was very fortunate. My dad was a better father than he was an inventor.
Well, that is high praise indeed. David Gerber, thanks so much.
It's my great pleasure to be here. Thank you, John.
David Gerber is the son of inventor H. Joseph Gerber and the author of The Inventor's Dilemma, The Remarkable Life of H. Joseph Gerber.
That's The Takeaways, John Hockenberry.
Police officers are the gateway to the mental health system. That's what officers are learning in one program aimed at helping them de-escalate mental health crises that so often lead to violence. KJZZ's Lauren Gilger takes us to a crisis intervention team training at the Tempe Police Department for more.
Drop the knife.
Officers are surrounding a man who kidnapped a baby. He's barricaded himself behind a store with the child and is holding a knife.
You don't want to do this. You don't want to hurt your baby.
He tells them he needs to protect the baby. The officer's guns are drawn.
Nobody's going to get hurt. What is your name? I want to talk with you.
But they don't shoot.
They engage the individual. They don't shoot. And they try to build a rapport with the person. They did not enter into his delusions, but they acknowledge them.
Frank O'Halloran and Joel Conger teach crisis intervention team training to officers from police departments throughout Maricopa County for the region's Behavioral Health Authority, Mercy Maricopa Integrated Care. Today, on the last day of training, behavioral health professionals are acting out real-life crisis scenarios and testing how the officers respond.
There doesn't have to be a bloodbath today.
During the week-long voluntary training program, officers are introduced to the resources available in the mental health system. They learn de-escalation techniques and get an introduction to behavioral health diagnoses, Conker said.
Just a very brief introduction to help try and maybe make some of the stuff they're seeing every day make a little more sense to them.
The first responders are not only first responders to crime, but we're also the gateway to the mental health system. And the two systems are connected.
That's O'Halloran. He retired from the Scottsdale Police Department 2 years ago after 25 years on the job. He spent much of it as a negotiator on their SWAT team. In the early days, he said they were called hostage negotiators. But now the name has changed to crisis negotiators.
Because the reality is, of all the negotiations I performed, it was only one where I had a true hostage situation. And everybody else was in a very deep crisis, suicidal crisis, and they were probably holding a gun to their head.
Back then, when officers encountered a mentally ill person experiencing a crisis, their options were slim.
Before was an emergency, it was an emergency department or maybe county psych, but probably jail. They probably went to jail, and we let the jail deal with it.
In 2012, the Arizona Department of Corrections reported that more than a quarter of the state's prison population had a mental health diagnosis.
I remember the days when we used to bring people to the county hospital. It would take us 3 to 4 hours. We just didn't have the time, nor the resources, or even the knowledge to do anything any different.
This is still a pattern, but O'Halloran says he's seen CIT training put a dent in it. They've seen police drop-offs for mental health services steadily increase in the 14 years they've been training in crisis intervention.
And what that tells us is that is a pre-jail diversion.
Are you okay? You seem kind of stressed right now.
I'm freaking pissed off, man.
In another scenario, officers pull over a veteran who blacked out on the road.
Can you do me a favor and just step out of the vehicle and talk with me?
Do I got to step out of the vehicle now?
No, I just love
Mercy to. Maricopa is helping to expand crisis services this year, including CIT trainings.
We want the students to understand how vast the crisis system is here in Maricopa County and how available the crisis services are.
Officers can call a crisis team for someone, get them a respite bed, or take them to an emergency psychiatric center. Still, Conger and O'Halloran say officers largely aren't aware of what mental health resources are available.
Some officers do, but it's very hit and miss.
But more departments are training officers about the available resources at the front end. And that, O'Halloran says, will continue to make a dent in the pattern.
Because we actually provide resources for police officers to change that pattern of bringing somebody to jail.
In Tempe, Lauren Gilger, KJZZ News.
A new megachurch is on the cusp of going up in the valley, and its pastor, Mark Driscoll, left his Mars Hill Church in Seattle in 2014 following a long list of controversies, including allegations of plagiarism and misogyny. Seattle Times reporter Nina Shapiro has been covering Driscoll and joins me now. Nina, there were also financial-related accusations, but what really stood out?
What he was really known for, just by people at large in Seattle, were these very provocative and many would consider outrageous statements about women and gender relations. So he had a very old-fashioned macho view of the world. He often talked about the U.S. as being a feminized nation, except he used a much cruder term. He once said that women were created in order to satisfy men's sexual urges, but again, used much cruder terms. He really had a view of the world that was offensive to many people in Seattle, but also appealed to certain elements in Seattle.
And as the issues piled up, he started to shun church members, right?
When you talk to people now, what's really striking is how that trauma still resonates. And they talk about it as abuse, as a kind of spiritual abuse. And you just feel the pain that still exists for these people. And so in Seattle, there's a feeling that Mark Driscoll never reconciled and owned up to the trauma that he left in his wake. And it's kind of incomprehensible for a lot of people here to understand how he can just move to Phoenix, start all over as if nothing happened.
Is there any indication of any kind that he has been humbled? Does he feel like the accusations against him were false? There are people who leave positions and then they'll say, well, it was just sort of time for me to go without ever admitting fault. Is he someone like that?
Well, he has said some things that indicate that he has become more humble, and as he's gone around soliciting support from other megachurch pastors around the country, he has conveyed that, and he's talked about healing up and made some signs that he has learned from his mistakes or is in the process of trying to learn from his mistakes. But what people here really see is that he hasn't really owned up to what has happened. And often when he has spoken about that experience, he's talked about it in terms of the harm that was caused to him and his family and how traumatic it was for him to have to move and everything that happened in those terms. But he hasn't, aside from some passing mentions to healing and that kind of thing, he hasn't really reckoned publicly or even privately with what's happened. He doesn't even mention Marcel. It's like it never happened. So, you know, far from kind of acknowledging what happened and the lessons learned, he just is moving on without talking about it.
Is there anyone who is feeling like they want, I know it's only been a few days since we know about Driscoll coming to Phoenix, but is there an impression that they might want to say, hey, this guy did wrong and you and Phoenix should know about this? Or is it almost like we were hurt and now I just sort of want to go inside now as opposed to fighting him?
I think they would like people to know about it. I really do. I mean, there was a movement as he started picking up steam and was back in the public arena. There were people who were trying to organize and, you know, stop him, really. You know, I've heard some rumblings about people trying to get in touch with pastors in Phoenix. I don't know where that is right now. It is surprising to me, frankly, that he has been able to get so much support from pastors in Phoenix as well as around the country.
That's Seattle Times reporter Nina Shapiro. We've been talking about Pastor Mark Driscoll, who's planning to start the Trinity Church in Phoenix later this year.
And still to come, new research looks at how the convenience of Amazon affects local economies.
We want our cake and eat it too. We want the jobs. We want the quaint little storefronts when we want them. But unfortunately, what we're seeing with a study like this is that it's nearly impossible to have both.
That's ahead. It's the show.
Good afternoon. With Mark, I'm Steve. In Valley traffic, an accident on the 101 northbound in Scottsdale at Chaparral Road. We're expecting sunny skies through the rest of this afternoon. We may reach a high temperature of 64. We should have clear skies tonight with lows around 40, sunny and warmer tomorrow with a high of 69. Currently, relative humidity is at 12%, mostly clear skies and 60 degrees at KJZZ at 236.
KJZZ is supported by the University of Arizona Cancer Center at Dignity Health St. Joseph's Hospital, bringing comprehensive cancer care to downtown Phoenix. Learn more at dignityhealth.org/UACC.
Good afternoon. This is the show on KJZZ. In a check of international news, with millions of refugees and migrants on the move, many countries in and around Europe are having to cope with hundreds of thousands of people crossing their borders.
It's a challenge Kenya has had to deal with for 25 years, as civil war in Somalia created what is still the world's largest refugee camp at Dadaab in northeastern Kenya. The BBC's Alistair Leithhead reports on the lessons learned from Somalia's great migrant crisis.
Under the harsh sun of a wind-blown desert in the northeast of Kenya is the country's third biggest city, after Nairobi and Mombasa. But the people here in Dadaab are refugees, and some have been here for 25 years.
Well, I've climbed up to the top of one of the huge water towers that spread around this vast camp, and you get a real sense from up here of the extent of this series of camps. 350,000 people live here. They have nothing like the services that you get of a city that size. As far as I can see are these glints of tin roofs in the distance, and then to this side, the desert, the dust, and beyond that, the Somali border.
In one patch of open sand, a football match is going on. The kids are young. Most were born here.
What's your name? Alan Isaac Beko. Okay, and how old are you?
22 years old. I was born and raised here.
Have you ever left?
No, nowhere.
So you've never left the confines of this camp?
No.
When civil war broke out in Somalia in 1991, a temporary camp was set up in Kenya for 90,000 people. But the long trail of refugees grew as the war with Islamist al-Shabaab fighters intensified. Drought and famine worsened the migrant crisis. At one point, 500,000 people lived here. This was an al-Shabaab attack on a beachside hotel in Mogadishu this month. Suicide bombings have joined the insurgents' armory. For many, going home is still impossible. A woman presents her ration card to be verified.
So she's just putting a finger on the fingerprint button. So there we go, result of verify match. So she has linked up with her ration card, and now we'll pick up her food and we'll get her SIM card loaded with some money to be spent on something else later.
The technology has changed. Giving cash rather than food is very new, but everyone here lives on aid. They're not allowed to work. Kenya's policy is for non-integration and would like the camps to close. And now the rations have been reduced as the world's attention and aid agencies are focused elsewhere. Zamzam Harrier Youssef uses a dribble of water and a brush to clean the couple of square meters of dust between the shacks her family built and share. She's 19 and has been stuck in this limbo all her life. The difference between the camp and Somalia, she said, is you get education here, but after school there are no jobs, and it's not safe. You can easily be killed in these camps, she said. Zamzam is hoping she can get a scholarship to study in Canada. Gamana Salat introduces her seven children, all born here. She was just 14 when she arrived, nearly 25 years ago. They're waiting for a bus. She's decided it's time to go home.
When I arrived here, life was good. But now the living conditions have deteriorated. That's why I am going back.
As the bus arrived, she told me she has no family, no land, no real idea of what Somalia can give her and the children. But she's determined to invest in her country, she says.
That's the BBC's Alistair Leithhead.
New research finds Amazon sold more than $44 billion worth of stuff in 2014. In Arizona, it sold almost $783 million worth of goods. The study from the group Civic Economics is called Amazon and Empty Storefronts and also shows Arizona and its cities missed out on around $20 million in sales taxes on things sold on Amazon. But unlike many other states, Amazon's presence led to more than 4,600 jobs gained here. Joining me to talk about the study and what it means for Arizona is Kimber Lanning, founder and director of Local First Arizona. Kimber, what do you make of the findings?
Well, I think it's important for people to really understand that their spending has a direct impact on the quality of life in our communities. And so if we're going to continue to choose to shop online without going out and actually interacting and supporting the businesses, then the direct result of that is going to be boarded up storefronts and or fewer job opportunities, particularly for the next generation.
How do you make that argument, though? Because it's frankly really convenient to shop online. You don't have to go somewhere. You don't have to worry about whether or not they have what it is you're looking for. It's really convenient to sit on your couch and order stuff online.
It absolutely is convenient. There's no question about it. And I think that's one of the challenges that we're facing in this country is we want our cake and eat it, too. We want the jobs. We want the quaint little storefronts when we want them. But unfortunately, what we're seeing with a study like this is that it's nearly impossible to have both. And so I don't quite know what the answer is, Mark, but I do want people to think clearly about at least shifting a portion of their spending to actually interacting with the stores.
I want to ask you about the storefront aspect of this report. The researchers found that Amazon sales basically cost the equivalent of 550 retail storefronts in Arizona.
Do you think that absent Amazon, that Arizona would really have 550 more independent stores?
I don't know that they would have that many, but I do know that they would have a significantly larger number of independent retail stores. You can see we're still recovering from the recession. And it's a combination of several things, Mark. It's a combination of having Amazon be so convenient, but it's also the fact that we have in Arizona, we've got 96% of our money deposited in non-local banks. And what that means is that when they don't have localized decision-making in Arizona, they are less likely to be lending to our independent retailers. And so that is also stifling economic recovery and adds to fewer independent storefronts in Arizona.
Do you think that independent stores can help sort of close this gap by upping their online presence and making it in many ways possible, in some ways maybe more convenient for customers to shop local stores online?
I do think that independent businesses always need to be more competitive and more up-to-date with their technology, and we're constantly advocating for that. But there are tools and resources available. They don't have the marketing dollars that Amazon does. But I encourage people to seek them out and find other ways to shop online and still keep those dollars recirculating right here in Arizona.
One of the other findings of this report that I wanted to ask you about is the number of net jobs gained. And Arizona was actually fifth on the list as far as the number of jobs that Amazon helped produce in this state, more than 4,600. What do you make of that?
Well, I think that's very real, and we want to give them credit for that. They have a very large warehouse in Arizona. It doesn't change the fact that the vast majority of states experienced a massive loss. But we are sitting pretty good because they're here, right here in Arizona. But it's important. What I like about this study is that Amazon constantly takes credit for the jobs they created without taking credit for the jobs that they eliminated. And this study at least gets it to a realistic number by also subtracting the number of jobs they eliminated.
Kimber Lanning is the founder and director of Local First Arizona. Kimber, thanks.
Thank you very much, Mark.
We also reached out to Amazon to get its take on the study and its results, but the company did not return our calls and emails. It's almost time for the next episode of The Quiz Show. That's when we bring back our resident quiz master and Jeopardy! Tournament of Champions winner, Leszek Pawlowicz. He'll face off against a KJZZ staff member in a game of trivia, but you can get in on the action too. Just solve this puzzle. On my way to California, I saw a man with seven kids. Each kid had seven sacks. Each sack had seven cats. Each cat had seven kittens. Kittens, cats, sacks, kids, how many were going to California? When you have the answer, email us at theshow@kjzz.org. We'll randomly draw two names from the correct answers, and either Leszek or one of our KJZZ newsroom staffers will play on your behalf. If your player wins, you'll win a special KJZZ item. If you are a member of Generation Z, you do not remember life before the internet, which frankly makes me feel a little bit old. Generation Z, generally people born between 1995 and 2010, appears to have a distinct learning style and outlook on the world. That's according to new research from a pair of University of Arizona grads in their new book, Generation Z Goes to College. Corey C. Miller is one of the authors. She's also an assistant professor of leadership studies at Wright State University in Dayton, Ohio. Corey, what are some of the differences between Generation Z and millennials?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question because as time goes on, generations appear to get shorter and shorter, and that's because of the advancement of technology mostly. So if you're starting to look at what these Generation Z, we looked at the students, how they might differ from millennials, is they're really coming from a perspective of realism. If you think about the oldest of them right now, they grew up in a time of post 9/11 and the recession. Many of them looked around and saw their friends and family members lose jobs and lose homes. They know that getting a job isn't a guarantee, and they're just a lot more pragmatic. When you think about millennials, when a lot of them came of age, it was the advent of the internet. You had a budget surplus. It was pre-9/11, things just were more optimistic. So certainly for their perspectives, their defining characteristics are quite different from each other. if you look at even things like their learning styles and their technology use and communication patterns, you're going to see some vast differences between them. If you look at technology, this is where we're going to see some of the biggest differences. They, first off, in our study, when we asked them their preferences for communication, they actually identified face-to-face communication was far more preferable for them than any forms of technology. Now, Generation Z is also all over social media. They're not using Facebook as much. They use it to connect with older adults. They use Instagram, but they love social media like Snapchat and Whisper, where they can post something and then it goes away quickly. They have very heightened sense of privacy settings, and they tend to follow more than they share on social media. And so millennials, they might share more than they follow.
When you talk about the pragmatism that a lot of these members of Generation Z feel, how does that impact their decisions whether to go to college, what they study in college, what kinds of careers or jobs they might want to pursue?
It's interesting because Generation Z still finds great value in a college degree, but they're also realizing that there are other options out there for jobs that don't necessarily require them to have a degree. And a lot of them are incredibly stressed out about the tuition, just the vast debt that they have to go into in order to go to college. So they're questioning, all right, what is it that I want to do that's going to be meaningful for me that I'm willing to invest in my college education? So they're coming to college knowing that they don't just want any job. They want a job that they feel passionate about. And that's sort of a paradox because in one sense, they know that they're not guaranteed any job, yet they're fairly picky about what they're willing to take. So interestingly, a lot of them want to work for themselves. They have a really great streak of entrepreneurism that runs through this generation. And many, many, many plan to work for themselves or work freelance.
So if I can ask you to look into your crystal ball for just a minute here, obviously this group of people is still relatively young. How do you foresee the traits and the attributes that many of them have sort of playing out into the future, and what might that mean for the country and our society going forward?
Yeah, they're definitely exhibiting some trends and some traits right now that are helping us even make some of those determinations early on. They are what we call a social change-minded generation. When asked a lot about how they want to engage in their communities and make a difference, they were asked about volunteering, and they said, we don't really love to volunteer. We don't want to go necessarily do a one-time service, community service project in which we might spend 5 hours. We want to deal with the underlying problem that causes a need for that service. Now, you add to that their pragmatic, responsible, loyal characteristics, their excitement for entrepreneurism, and the fact that more than 40% of them want to actually invent something that will change the world. You're looking at a very creative and very dedicated group of people who want to leave their mark by changing the world and actually addressing some problems that have been ongoing for generations. They see themselves as the game changers.
Corey C. Miller is an assistant professor of leadership studies at Wright State University in Ohio, also a graduate of the University of Arizona. She's recently published some research about the educational motivations and learning styles of Generation Z. Corey, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
My name is Alton Jones, and I come to get a haircut because I got tired of looking like a bushman.
Hey, now, how y'all doing?
Natural Impressions, I come twice a month. This is the best place to come get a haircut in the city. It's the Poor Man's Country Club. That's what it is. People you haven't seen in a while, you know.
I'm holding on, doctor.
And then, you know, you get to talk about everything. Politics, church, movies, sports, you name it. It's just the hot spot.
Okay, guys. Thanks a lot, man.
That's Alton Jones getting a haircut at Natural Impressions Barbershop. If you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix, or just think we need to take a little bit more off the top, send us a note, theshow@kjzz.org.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. He's Steve. I'm Mark. In Valley traffic on the 101 northbound in the East Valley, the accident at Chaparral, now just blocking the shoulder, had been blocking the right lane. Also, some pretty heavy slowing on the 202 westbound from a little bit past 40th Street on into about 24th Street. Look for sunny skies for the rest of the afternoon with a high of 64 degrees. 70 is average for today. Clear tonight, overnight lows near 40. It's 60 degrees at KJZZ at 255.
KJZZ is supported by Squire Patton Boggs, an integrated legal practice with 44 offices in 21 countries, a law firm with local connections and global influence. You can learn more at squirepattonboggs.com.
A new publication is available to the public this month, and it focuses on an underserved group, people with disabilities. Livability Magazine is put together by Ability 360 in Phoenix, which works to empower disabled residents to become independent. Lauren Worthington is executive editor of Livability. And Lauren, is the magazine more focused on promoting understanding among people who are not disabled, or is it to help those who are disabled learn about some of the accomplishments of their peers?
Well, I think it's both. We definitely want to expose the general community to a lot of great people doing a lot of interesting things who, by the way, happen to have a disability. And then also we want to show other people within our disability some of the things that are going on in hopes that they will see there's potential for maybe themselves or a family member that is perhaps new to a disability and want to get more information.
So where's the balance between the text, the storytelling, and the photos? Because I really feel like having looked at a little bit of it, it's very powerful to see some of these photographs.
Yeah, I mean, when we decided to make the magazine, it was a couple of us that have backgrounds in photography, others graphics, and then people who are talented writers. And all of us came to the table to say, look, that a lot of times it's the visual, the photography, that's going to get somebody to read it because they're going to see that it's about a person with a disability, and that might not be the most comfortable thing. But yet if they can see that it's a person who is just like them in every other way, then we've accomplished what we set out to do.
I'm curious about your disability, and what did it take for you to feel maybe some of the feelings you're hoping the people who read the magazine will feel?
I've been in a wheelchair for 30 years from a spinal cord injury. It's something that now I'm very comfortable with, but there was a time when I was not, to the point where I probably went out of my way more than once to avoid a mirror even, just because it didn't seem like me. But over time, I've become comfortable with it. And when I picked up a camera and started doing photography, then I really decided that I was actually pretty good at taking images of people with disabilities and making sure that the photos were positive, that they weren't in any way maybe embarrassing or at an angle that wasn't something that people with disabilities would feel comfortable with, or I just understood what it meant to be to take a photo of a person with a disability and put it in the best light possible.
Is it one of those things you can't quite define, or can you, you know, beyond obviously certain angles and whatnot as a photographer? But photographers are also artists. Is there something in the way that you approach it to make it so it's not like the disability that's being emphasized, it's the beauty of the photo?
The answer is yes, but it really boils down to the person and why are we taking a picture of this person. But it's also knowing when does a person feel comfortable, whether it's in their wheelchair or because maybe they have a visual impairment and they don't even exactly know what the image is going to look like. They're having to trust me because their visual impairment means they'll never see the photo.
Lauren Worthington of the new Livability magazine from Ability 360 in Phoenix.
Make sure you're with us tomorrow afternoon at 2 on the show. Glendale considers a new scenic corridor. And how much should universities consider a donor's pass in an effort to avoid controversy? Those stories and a whole lot more tomorrow afternoon at 2 on the show.
The show was produced by our senior producers, Jimmy Jenkins and Sarah Ventry, with help from Bruce Drummond, Anika Klein, Regina Revasova, and Tiara Vian. Sky Shout and Domenico Nicosia are our digital team. The managing editor is Tracy Greer. The news director is Al Macias. Center executive producer is John, the quarantined one, Hoban.
Unfortunately, right now, that is the case. We always want to hear from you. Let us know what you think. Good story ideas. The show at KJZZ.org. Also, don't forget to download the free KJZZ mobile app. You can podcast this very program at your leisure. It's
how much does that cost, Mark?
$0. $0. It's totally free. The Apple App Store, Google Play. Get it now on your smartphone. This is member-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. For Steve Goldstein, I'm Mark Brody. All Things Considered is next at 3 o'clock.